From NPR, StoryCorps, and the National September 11th Memorial and Museum, this is We Remember, StoryCorps Stories from 9/11. I'm Audie Cornish. John and Elaine Leinung lost their son Paul on 9/11. They knew they had to tell his story at the StoryCorps recording booth, and they knew why.
This was a way for us to kind of carve our private space with Paul.
Right, it preserved our family's story.
Preserved, yeah.
Our memory of our son.
Yeah.
And our loss.
On the 10th anniversary of the attacks, we visit with some extraordinary families. They tell stories of loved ones lost on 9/11 and reveal what gives them strength today. These are personal tales created with a determination to share and remember. The clouds of smoke, the plumes of dust, the piles of twisted steel. As much as we might try to forget, it seems we cannot escape the picture of that morning in September. We've had 10 years to think about 9/11. And now, a chance to carry forward a different kind of memory. The girl with the twinkle in her eye. The firefighter with the big bear hug. The equities trader leading people to safety from the 78th floor. These are sons and wives and daughters and grandfathers, and they are remembered here in rich and loving detail by families and friends for StoryCorps, the recording project that records conversations between Americans across the country. Here's StoryCorps founder Dave Isay.
We started StoryCorps in 2003, and it's a very simple idea. We put a booth in Grand Central Terminal where you can bring anyone who you want to honor by listening to their story to this booth. You go inside. It's kind of a sacred space. The lights are low. You sit across from, say, your grandmother for 40 minutes, and you talk. There's a facilitator in the corner. And at the end of the 40 minutes, two CDs have been burned. One goes home with you, and the other stays with us and goes to an archive at the Library of Congress. So 100 years from now, your great-great-grandkids can get to know your grandmother through her voice and story.
On the fifth anniversary of September 11th in 2006, StoryCorps began an initiative with the National 9/11 Memorial and Museum. Their goal was to record one story for every life that was lost on September 11th.
To date, we've recorded upwards of 1,000 9/11 stories. But of those 1,200 stories, we've memorialized 583 different individual victims of the attacks. You know, I think there are many families for whom it's still too difficult to do this. And we look at ourselves at StoryCorps. We are a public service project. We are here to serve our participants, and in this case, to serve the families of the 9/11 victims. These are hard stories to listen to, but this is about remembering. The enormity of what happened on September 11th is very difficult to conceive. And the only way that we can understand the loss is to break it down into the individual stories, you know, to each of the lives through storytelling. We're trying to make sure that families have this record of lives of loved ones that will live on, and that all of us can understand the enormity of what happened on that day, can think about the lives that were lost and never forget.
Allison and Jefferson Crowther lost their son, Wells Crowther, on 9/11. Wells was an equities trader in the South Tower of the World Trade Center. Here's his story.
Oh, he was a high adventurer. He was high energy. Oh, high energy.
We took Wells and his sister Honor down to Disney World, and Wells was 5 and Honor was 3. And we got on Space Mountain, and we get in this car, and Wells is all the way up front. I'm right behind him, and this thing takes off in the dark, and we're whipping around. And Wells is just, I could sense he was, like, vibrating. He was so happy and thrilled to be on this thing. Mm. We got down to the bottom, and all Wells could say was, again.
Right.
Again.
Gotta
so
go.
So I had to take him. The two of us had to ride that darn thing again. He was born 5/17/77 at 11:50 p.m. Tuesday.
On a Tuesday.
He was Tuesday's child. You know, Monday's child is fair of face. Tuesday's child is full of grace. He was born on a Tuesday. He died on a Tuesday. And his body was recovered on a Tuesday. He was truly Tuesday's child.
Allison and Jefferson, you recorded that interview 5 years ago in 2006. And what is it like to hear those words again?
It's very emotional. It always will be very emotional for us. We loved our son so much. And, you know, when we recall these beautiful times we had with him and his very special spirit, he was such a good soul and so full of adventure and courage. It makes us sad that we don't have him with us anymore.
Can you tell us a little bit more about your son, about Wells? Because we've learned quite a bit about him over the years. You know, he was a hero.
You know, he was a volunteer firefighter. And in the fire services, when someone has done what everybody considers to be a heroic act, in the fire services we say he did his duty. And it's not something that is over the top, but it's what's expected of you. And as a trained volunteer firefighter, Wells did what was expected, and he did his duty. And everybody looks at it and says, wow, what a hero. Wells was a young man who loved everybody. He had so many friends. And he, even though these were people he had never met, those 20-some people on the 78th floor sky lobby that he rescued and saved and led to safety down those stairs, for him, that was just totally natural. He knew that's what he had to be doing, and he did his duty.
What was inside Wells was a moral sense of right and wrong. And to him, helping save lives that day, he had to have realized that this was a very big thing that was happening, a huge attack after he saw, you know, realized the second tower, his tower was hit. So he was on the front line of whatever battle this was.
I tell people have said to us, you raised your son too well. And I say, no. No, you don't understand. This young man came with the software installed. The good Lord put him here for a purpose and probably said, look, at some point, Wells, I'm going to need your help. Now, unfortunately, it was 24 years into his life, but they were 24 incredible years. For us, they were magical years. He was a delight, just as they are with his two younger sisters, who we love dearly, and his four nieces and nephews, who are incredible little rascals that we love dearly. But, you know, Allison and I don't live in the past. We live in the present, and we live for the future, the future being our two daughters and our four grandchildren. We never, ever forget the past, however, and Wells is a major part of that past.
I think also what helps us is that when we think about all the years that we did have with Wells, there's nothing we feel that we could have done more. It was such a rich and loving relationship with all of us in the family, and he lived such a rich and full life while he was here for his 24 years. At least we have that without any regrets whatsoever about, you know, anything left unsaid or undone. It was a beautiful, full relationship and experience we had with Wells.
Allison and Jefferson Crowther, remembering their son, Wells. Frankie DeVito was 4 when he lost his grandfather, Bill Steckman, who worked in the World Trade Center. Frankie talked to his mother, Diana, in 2006.
We used to play Peter Pan, and we used to use the screwdrivers as swords and pretend I was like Peter Pan and he was Captain Hook. He always used to be in the garage fixing up things with Cousin Mikey, and he also promised me he'd take me to his work once, but that's not going to happen.
I know you were young when it happened. You were only in kindergarten. Is there a time that you were the most scared when all that was going on?
I didn't know that something happened until I came into the living room and you were upset. You said there was something wrong with Papa. That made me scared. Remember that Mikey told me that planes crashed and he wasn't coming back.
Is there anything you did that made you feel better to go to sleep at night?
Going up to Grandma or my parents, giving them a hug, resting on their shoulder. And sometimes when I'm in my room, I pretended that Grandpa was right there, nothing was wrong, and my teddy was right there. So that helps me.
Do you think you're different now than you were before we lost Papa?
Yeah, I think I'm different because being in certain places when I'm at a happy time, just somewhere in my mind, he just won't get out of there. He's just stuck in my mind, and that makes me a little sadder where I am. And I have dreams with him. I always imagine us, like, seeing each other again and being really happy as a family without being sad or anything on September 11th.
If you could talk to him right now, what would you want to say?
I love you, and there's no other grandfather I'd rather see than you.
Frankie DeVito is in the 10th grade now. He's a safety on his high school football team. He says his grandpa taught him to live life to the fullest and to enjoy every day as it comes. David DeRubio was with Engine Company 226 in the Borum Hill section of Brooklyn on the morning of September 11th. His daughter Jessica was 12 years old at the time. She visited StoryCorps in 2005.
Sometimes it's hard for me to remember him because I was little, but I have to say that his hugs, like, you know, I remember them so much. When I used to hug him, the whole world disappeared because he just would cover me and that would be it. Ever since I could remember, he wanted to be a firefighter. He wanted to be just like his brothers. And I remember he finally did it, and he called me on the phone, and he was just ecstatic. Like, he didn't know what to do. He couldn't believe it. It was his dream. He never wanted to move up. He never wanted to be a captain. He wanted to stay a firefighter for the rest of his life. No matter how much I want him to be here, I still know that his dream was always to be a firefighter, and I don't think he would have wanted to have died any other way.
Jessica DeRubio remembering her dad, David DeRubio. I'm Audie Cornish, and you're listening to We Remember, StoryCorps Stories from 9/11. When StoryCorps opened its booth at Ground Zero in 2005, Richard Pecorella wanted to be one of the first there to record his story. He lost his fiancée, Karen Jude, on September 11th. She worked as a secretary at the financial services firm Cantor Fitzgerald on the 101st floor of the North Tower. Richard describes the first time he saw Karen.
I knew as soon as I looked at her that she was the one. It was magical. I can't describe it. I couldn't tell her that, but I was like a 15-year-old again. I got all googly-eyed and didn't know what to do or say, and stumbling wasn't like me at all. Wasn't the typical macho Italian guy from Brooklyn. When I met Karen, somehow she relaxed me. She just taught me patience. I had very little patience. Basically, I was, you know, one of those guys rolled down the window and screamed at the drivers when they weren't driving the way I thought they should be. And she toned me down. She showed me to be nicer to people. Give it a second thought before you start yelling. And I've carried that with me. Other than her going to work, there wasn't a time we weren't together. Every morning, Karen would drive with me to my office, and then she'd take the subway from my office one stop to the Trade Center. I worked in Brooklyn, so my window across the East River, I could see the Twin Towers. So I'm doing some work, and one of my workers comes in and says, Richie, I just heard that the Trade Center got hit with a plane. I turn around, and I see the building burning. And I took my office chair, and I threw it at my window. So they brought the nurse up. She gives me a bottle of water. I have the bottle of water, and it's in my hand, and my hand is trembling so much that it's splashing all over me. I couldn't even hold the bottle in my hand. I miss her eyes. Her eyes sparkled to me. One day they were blue, next day they were green, depending on how the light hit them. Karen, I'll always be in love with you, and I will see you again.
That's Richard Pecorella. We spoke with him recently at his home in Brooklyn.
I'm a driving billboard for 9/11. I have a picture of Karen with her name, her birthday, her year she died, who she worked for. And I have the flag with in the rear window of my truck, the flag of honor, which has the names of everybody that died that day, including Pennsylvania and the Pentagon. I have that there all the time, and I just, wherever I am, that's with me. I was never involved in much charitable work or looking at people. I stereotype people in the past. And now I give everybody a fair chance. And when I think somebody needs help, I try to help them. Not only my family, even strangers and friends. And I just try to make it a point to do good things rather than trying to hurt anybody. The main thing is just we have to keep the memories of our loved ones alive. I guess I'm here for a reason, so. And that's to, you know, keep going and keep helping my family and anybody else I can help. And that's what I really believe now. I believe I'm here to do good, to help people.
Richard Pecorella created a memorial garden in Brooklyn. He calls it his Garden of Angels. In the garden are photos of Karen and people from his neighborhood in Brooklyn who were killed on 9/11. He visits Karen's memorial every day. John Vigiano Jr. was a New York City firefighter. His younger brother, Joe, was a detective on the city's police force. Here is their father, retired firefighter John Vigiano Sr.
There were a couple of days each year you were allowed to take your children to work, and Joe loved it. That was his birthday present, that he would come and spend the night in the firehouse. We'd have a cake, and the guys I work with, they would take a milk container and they'd cut out the facsimile of a building and they'd put it on the top of the cake and then they would light it up. And they would tell Joe to put it out and he would throw a pot of water on it. The birthday cake was a little soggy, but this is what he wanted. Joe started dating a young lady whose father was a police officer. And he come home one day and he says, "I'm taking a police test." I says, "Joe, you're only 17 years old." He says, "No big deal." He passed the test. And when he graduated, they assigned him to East New York, where I started my career. On the other side of the room, my son, John, wanted nothing to do with police or emergency service or fire department. He wanted to be the next Donald Trump. He was going to make $1 million and take care of his mother and father. But in 1984, I came down with throat cancer. He noticed then how my unit took care of us. And he says, "I'm going to become a fireman." I says, "You're kidding me. Firemen don't make millions of dollars. How am I going to live like a king?" But I was very happy, very proud. My father had been on the fire department, and he was the first one to be issued badge number 3436. And when John decided he wanted to be a firefighter, they reissued it to my son, John. So the badge was only used by two. Both the boys would call me when they were working. John would always call around 3:30, 4 o'clock. And that particular night, September 10th, we spoke for a few minutes. And I says, "I love you." And he says, "I love you." Joe called me in the morning and told me to turn on the television that a plane just hit the Trade Center. He says, "I'm heading south on West Street. This is a big one." And I just said, "Be careful. I love you." I said, "I love you too." That was it. We had the boys for John for 36 years, Joe for 34 years. Ironically, badge number 3436. I don't have any could've, should've, or would've's. I wouldn't have changed anything. There's not many people that the last words they said to their son or daughter was, "I love you." And the last words they heard was I love you. So that makes me sleep at night.
John Vigiano Sr., remembering his sons, John Jr., of New York Fire Department's Ladder Company 132, and Joe, a detective with the New York City Police Department. Jack Murray watched the World Trade Center's collapse from the roof of his apartment building in Manhattan. He's a welder by trade, and he made his way to Ground Zero volunteering to cut steel.
If you were going to find somebody that day to go down there who was pragmatic and clear-headed, I was not that guy. I honestly thought that the world was going to come to an end. Maybe it seems silly now, but I thought, this is absolutely a nuclear event. Today's the last day I'm alive. And so I thought, okay, well, I'm going to go downstairs and see if the neighborhood corner bar is open. I was just going to sit there with other people and see what was going to be done. One of the owners of the bar, who I was good friends with, came directly over to me. And he said, you know, Jack, you're a welder. I've got construction experience. There are people suffering, and someone needs to do something about it. Do you want to go with me? I said, well, okay, let's do this. And we're among the first 20 steel burners to go in there. Later on in that first night, I had this thought that I was standing on this gigantic funeral pyre going into the earth, and that with all the heat that kept coming out from underneath the debris and the fires that would come up, I realized I was probably breathing in the ashen remains of some of the people. It was kind of like a communion for me.
9/11 recovery worker, Jack Murray. John Romanovich spent 4 months at Ground Zero, working for the Department of Design and Construction, the city agency in charge of cleaning up the site. He started work there just days after the attack.
I remember stepping off a bus that took us there, and I'd seen enough of it on television to pretty much know what to expect. But that initial impression was as if we had walked out of the audience and became part of the show, like we crossed into a different reality. I was working from 3 in the afternoon to 11 or midnight. By the time I got home, my wife and daughter were sleeping. When I woke up, I was alone. I'd have breakfast. One day, I was getting ready, and my identification to be able to access the site was gone. My daughter had taken my ID to school. Well, the next time that we were both home and awake, my daughter asked me to forgive her for taking it because she was just proud that she wanted to show her friends who I was. I think most of us consider ourselves just to be ants crawling around on the pile. But in her eyes, I was a big deal. I was going to Ground Zero every day. Going back to a regular, normal job, and a regular, normal existence. That was a real adjustment because we all eventually got to where that was where we felt normal. We didn't ever feel right when we had to leave, when we had to go home. So that was like you were getting cut from the team.
Recovery worker John Romanovich.
My name is Lee Hansen.
I'm Eunice Hansen.
We're here to talk about our children, Peter, our son, Sue Kim, our daughter-in-law, and our granddaughter, Christine Lee, who were all killed on 9/11 while flying on United Airlines 175. The morning of the 11th, we got up and we were having breakfast. We were talking about the kids taking the trip, and it was Christine's first trip in an airplane, and the phone rang, and it was Peter. He said, "Dad, we've been hijacked." He said, "I think they've already killed somebody, and I don't think the pilot's in control of the plane." I hung up, and I called the police. He called again and told me he thought they were going to crash into a building. And just after that, Peter very quietly said, "Oh, my God, oh, my God, oh, my God." And everything was cut off. We turned to the television, and we saw the airplane crash into it.
It had to be that they stayed together right to the end, died in each other's arms. To this day, Peter's friends are in contact with me, and I get cards and pictures of their children. I should be happy for them. And I am. But I think I don't have that anymore. I have nothing of the people I love the most.
Eunice and Lee Hansen. They've created a memorial garden in their hometown of Groton, Massachusetts, with three lilac bushes and one tree for their son, Peter. John Yates was working at the Pentagon when American Airlines Flight 77 crashed into the building.
One of my coworkers asked me if I knew what was going on in New York. So I said no, and she said, "Well, you got to come see." And there's a crowd of people watching the TV. So I stood there for a few minutes and watched. I called my wife. She said she knew, and I said, "Well, I just wanted to let you know I was okay." And she said, "Do me a favor. For the rest of the day, work from underneath your desk." So I laughed, and I said, "Yeah, honey, I will. I love you, and I'll see you tonight." And just as I decided to get up and leave, the plane hit the outside of the building. I was blown through the air, and when I landed, I really didn't know where I was. The room was just black, and everything I touched burned my hands. And I remember seeing just strings of skin, which was hanging off my hands from the burns. There's a lot of things that I don't remember to this day, but I remember a medic cutting all my clothes off of me and my wife waking me up, and I thought it was still September 11th, but it was September 13th. You know, when I went to watch what was going on in New York, I was standing in the middle of five people. And I'm the only one that survived.
Well, since I did my original interview, I've returned to work in the Pentagon full time. I have had another grandchild, so I now have a total of five. And I just, I'm doing the same thing I was doing on September 11th. I'm a security manager for one of the Army staff agencies in the Pentagon. I come to work every day. I'm in a different section of the building. I'm almost three quarters away from where the attack site was. And then, you know, I often go down to the second floor, and there's a small memorial right at the apex of the corridor at the E-ring that has all the pictures of all my friends who were killed that day. And it's just a time of reflection for just a moment when I walk by. You know, September 11th and the events of that day and my injuries, it's something that happened to me and my wife, but I don't let it control me. You know, there are some things I can't do. I don't spend a whole lot of time out in the sun. You know, I lead a normal life. I wake up every day and I give a silent thank you that I'm still here, and I just live each day as it comes. But I've moved on with my life. I still have good days. I still have bad days. You know, I still suffer from a little bit of post-traumatic stress disorder, but I've learned to deal with it. You know, I have my coping mechanisms and skills, and I'll mark this year's anniversary with I'm going to come here to this memorial ceremony, and then I'm going to go visit my friends who are buried over at Arlington Cemetery. I've not been able to do that up until now, but I feel I'm at a point in my life where I can now go over there and see them and visit with them.
That's John Yates. We spoke to him at his office in the Pentagon. I'm Audie Cornish. You're listening to We Remember, StoryCorps Stories from 9/11. When Monique Ferrer went to the StoryCorps booth, she wanted one thing: to memorialize her ex-husband, Michael Trinidad, for their two children. This is her story.
When I met Michael, I was 14 years old, and I knew that he was going to be my boyfriend. We got married when I was 19, and we were both kids. We really didn't know what next, you know, get married and now what. When we were divorced, I remember the kids telling me that their father confided in them with a secret and they didn't want to tell me. And I'm like, well, what's the secret? And they said, well, Daddy still loves you. He doesn't want us to tell you. And I said, well, I know, and I love him too. But Mommy and Daddy are gone their separate ways, but we'll always be a family and we'll always be your mom and dad. On 9/11, I remember getting up to take my daughter. She had a doctor's appointment, so my daughter was home. At 9:04, I got a phone call, and it was Michael. And he was calling from the 103rd floor. And the first thing that he said was, I'm calling to say goodbye. And I said, why? Where are you going? And he said, well, I'm in the building that was just hit by a plane. He just wanted to tell me how much he loved the children. And he says, you know, I also want to tell you that I always loved you. And I said, I know. The kids told me. And I'm remarried, so I asked my husband to get on the phone, and I thought maybe my husband could talk him into finding an exit. And when my husband got on the phone, he asked my husband if he would be my children's father. And my husband said, you're going to be coming home. You're going to be their dad. And I'm their dad too. And he's like, I don't think I'm going to make it. And my daughter was there, and she saw me becoming a little hysterical, and I didn't know whether to put her on because I didn't know how he would react. He thought she was at school. It just really breaks my heart that he's not here for them. It's like the only thing on his mind was to tell the kids that he loved them. And I tell the kids this every day. Everything you do, just think about your dad. And the thing is that my two children look just like him. And they talk like him. And they joke like him. So it's like he's there. You know, I see him in them every day. And as much as he used to drive me crazy, he was my family. And
my best friend.
When I recorded that story, I was in a very, very sad place, and I felt like I had to tell someone, and even if it was to record it, I had to say the story, because it was just haunting me, and I felt like I needed to record it for my children, get it out of me and put it out there in the world. And I'm glad I did. I felt so much better when I did that. And I felt like I was able to put a couple of things to rest, and I was at peace. A lot has happened, a lot has gone on. My oldest daughter, she graduated from high school, and she headed back to start college. And then she decided that she wanted to pursue her dream, which was also a dream of her father's, which was to become a professional wrestler. And she is a wrestler on TNA, and she's living her dream, and she's super happy, and we're all very proud of her. Timothy, he's 19 now, and he's attending college in Florida. We're doing so much better now, I have to say, since I recorded my story. You know, now we are moving on with our lives. We are going on to, you know, a different chapter in our lives, and the kids are grown up, and, you know, they're starting their lives as adults, and it's very nice to see, and I know that their father is looking down on them, and they make him very proud.
That's Monique Ferrer remembering her ex-husband, Michael Trinidad. Beverly Eckert lost her husband, Sean Rooney, in the South Tower of the World Trade Center.
Sean had warm brown eyes and dark curly hair, and he was a good hugger. We met when we were only 16 at a high school dance. And when he died, we were 50. It was about 9:30 a.m. when he called, and he told me he was on the 105th floor, and he'd been trying to find a way out. He told me that he hadn't had any success, and now the stairwell was full of smoke. I asked if it hurt for him to breathe, and he paused for a moment and then said no. He loved me enough to lie. We stopped talking about escape routes, and then we just began talking about all the happiness we shared during our lives together. I told him that I wanted to be there with him, die with him. But he said, no, he wanted me to live a full life. And as the smoke got thicker, he just kept whispering, I love you, over and over. I just wanted to crawl through the phone lines to him and hold him one last time. Then I heard a sharp crack, followed by the sound of an avalanche. It was the building beginning to collapse. Called his name into the phone over and over. Then I just sat there, pressing the phone to my heart. I think about that last half hour with Sean all the time. I remember how I didn't want that day to end, terrible as it was. I didn't want to go to sleep, because as long as I was awake, it was still a day that I'd shared with Sean. And he kissed me goodbye before leaving for work. I could still say that was just a little while ago. That was only this morning. And looking back on all that has happened since he died, and the causes I fought for, and the things I've done, I just think of myself as living life for both of us now. And I like to think that Sean would be proud of me.
I have to think about what I had, not what I lost. That's what Beverly said the day Sean died, according to her sister, Karen Eckert. Karen told us that Beverly believed there is strength after devastation and a way to make good out of evil. Beverly Eckert went on to become an advocate for families affected by September 11th. She died 2 years ago in the crash of Continental Flight 3407. She was on her way to Buffalo to award the Sean Rooney Scholarship in his name. Keith Mierholtz was an insurance broker for Marcia McLennan on the 100th floor of the North Tower. Mierholtz was on an express elevator when the first plane hit. It's a day he and his wife, Gret, still recall with fear.
Someone came in and into the room and said that the tower had fallen. And I thought that was it. I kind of gave up hope.
Fortunately, I didn't wait too long to call then.
Shortly after you called, I picked up the phone and you just said, "Gret, I'm alive." And I started screaming. And Tyler, all day he kept calling you Super Daddy. My daddy jumped over the building, or my daddy.
4-year-old.
We knew you'd make it, you know, do whatever you could to make it out.
Yeah.
And I love you because you make me laugh, even though I always say I'm funnier.
No way. I'm definitely funnier.
You make me laugh. And you're my best friend.
Yeah.
And it's nice to have a best friend to go through life with.
Since Keith and Gret recorded that interview, they've had a third child. Keith tells us that life is good and that sometimes, if you're lucky, you get a second chance.
My name is John Linung.
I'm Elaine Linung. I'm his wife. We're here at Grand Central Terminal to talk about our son, Paul James Battaglia, who was killed on 9/11.
His sister idolized him. Kristen, when she was a baby, she always used to save food for Paul.
Anything she'd save.
Whatever she got, she'd save a piece, save something for Paul.
And her first words were not even mommy or daddy, they were brubu. And you couldn't yell at Paul. It was my Paul. Leave my Paul alone.
Right.
Yes.
If you would try to scold him, she would come to his defense.
When the first plane hit, I thought maybe it was a commuter plane. And then I thought, oh, great. It's hit like right smack where Paul's office is. I hope to God he's not at his desk. I knew that if anything happened, the first thing Paul would do would call my dad. He was the firstborn grandson, very, very close with my father. They would go shopping together. They would go get haircuts together. And I just knew that he would call my dad and then me. And I called my dad and asked if he'd heard from Paul, and he said no. And then I said, well, turn on the TV. And my dad said, Elaine, we lost him. That's right where his office is, where the plane hit. And I called John. And I said, I don't know what we'll do. But it looks like he's gone.
I just kept hoping that it was, because the first one had hit a little, you know, before 9, I just kept hoping that, you know, maybe he was still down in the lobby or
no, he had
in an elevator. No,
he had early because he had a meeting and he left whistling that morning. He was very happy. He was going to his meeting. He was going to work. In fact, I was going to ask him to wait for me to ride the train with him because I loved to sit next to him on the train. I loved to smell his aftershave. We had such a happy night the night before. September 10th, 2001. We were joking and laughing, and I actually was so happy when I went to sleep that night. That's the thing that got me afterwards. I had no premonition. You think that you should know something horrible is going to happen to your child that day. And I was so happy that night, thinking that I had such a nice family. I had such a good life. And I was truly blessed. And then 12 hours later, it was very different. And I'll miss him until I die.
Yeah. It's
It's 5 years later since we recorded that, and it's, you know, it's emotional to hear it.
It's still emotional, yeah.
Because it's, you know, you never really leave that place. You know, you kind of learn to live with it, but you never really leave it. So, you know, however many years it is, however much time goes by, it's, you know, you're still in that place.
Yeah, there's no such thing as closure. I'm really not sure what people mean by closure. Grief is sort of cyclical, and you go through cycles of it, and it there are times, periods where it's less, but then anniversary reactions will come, things like his birthday, friends of his getting married and having babies bring it back. You do move forward, of course. You have to. I have two other children, and I needed for them to see that they were important and that their lives were important, and to mark events in their lives with as much ceremony and happiness as we could.
You know, that's been, I know, a big consideration for you, and you wanted your children to see that things could go on, and you've done that. You went back to school. You got your doctorate in nursing. You know, you're an accomplished professional person, and your children look up to that. There's one difference between losing someone and losing someone on 9/11, which is just that, you know, 9/11 has been in the news essentially every day for the last, you know, 9 coming on 10 years. There's no escape from it.
It's difficult, and it's everywhere you go. It's every magazine, it's every book, it's on every TV show. It's a post 9/11 world. Everyone has the story of where they were that day, and it makes it almost difficult to grieve because everyone almost feels they have a stake in 9/11 in some ways. And for me, this is going to sound terrible, but for me, getting a piece of something back wasn't going to be my son. It wasn't going to give me any closure. It wasn't going to be bringing him home. I'd like to think that he is somewhere in a better place. And I think part of me thinks that maybe if I behave good enough, I'll get to see him someday.
This was a way for us to kind of reclaim our kind of private little piece of it.
Right. It preserved our family's story.
Preserved, yeah.
Our memory of our son.
Yeah.
And our loss.
John and Elaine Leinung, remembering their son, Paul James Battaglia. He was 22 years old when he died on September 11th. We've been listening to stories of lives lost on 9/11, gathered by the StoryCorps Recording Project. There are more than 1,000 9/11 stories already, and more to be recorded, each with a permanent home at the Library of Congress. And with these stories, memories of how we found common ground. Here's StoryCorps founder Dave Isay.
After September 11th, there was this period of time here in New York, and I don't know if it's true in the rest of the country, but it was certainly true in New York. It was unlike any other time I've ever lived through. There was just this sense during this one brief moment that people would say hi to each other on the street or wouldn't honk, you know, in their cars. Everyone was willing to kind of help each other. And there was this kind of openness. And you know, for one brief moment, we were all brothers and sisters, and we were all kind of our best selves. And when I hear these stories, it, you know, I think it reminds us all of that feeling after September 11th. And, you know, I hope that that feeling of recognizing what's really important in life and how lucky we are to be alive, that we all feel that just for a moment and remember the lives that were lost on that day.
We Remember was produced by Carrie Thompson for NPR and Dave Isay and Isaac Kestenbaum for StoryCorps. Special thanks to the 9/11 families
and the National 9/11 Memorial and Museum. I'm Audie Cornish. This is NPR.